maybe even succumb to jealousy. Deep down, I knew the answer. Aside from Marge, I considered Emily to be my closest friend, and yet I hadn't told her what Vivian had said. Why couldn't I be honest with her about the conflict roiling within me? Perhaps a part of me felt that I'd been lying to Emily all along about my intentions. I wanted more than friendship. Not now, but down the road. And as selfish as it may seem, I didn't want to risk losing her before that, which left me even more conflicted about what exactly I should do. The day before Halloween, I made arrangements to check into a hotel. Marge and Liz had arrived home from Costa Rica late Wednesday night, and I didn't feel good about hitting them up for a place to stay. Nor did I want to stay with my parents. Though I knew they wouldn't have minded, I didn't want them to know about my further deteriorating relationship with Vivian. At London's birthday party, Vivian's cheerful facade had led my mom to pull me aside and try to convince me that Vivian still had feelings for me. That was a conversation I didn't want to face again. Taglieri texted that Vivian would be arriving early on Friday night, probably around 7, which meant there would be no date night with London. Instead, London and I ate at home. Afterwards, she ran up the stairs to shake on the hamsters and her fish while I started to clean the kitchen. I heard Vivian push through the door 20 minutes later. "Hello," she sang out. "I'm here." My heart started to race as if I'd been caught doing something I shouldn't, simply by being in my own house. Meanwhile, Vivian breezed in like she was the one who still lived here. Vivian poked her head into the kitchen, looking for London. "She's in her bedroom," I said. "She ran up there to check on her critters."
"Okay,"
she said, nodding.
"Did she eat?"
"I thought you told your attorney that we weren't supposed to communicate directly. But okay, I'll play along." "Yeah, she's had dinner. No bath yet. I didn't know if you were going to take her to a movie or..."
"I haven't decided yet. I'll talk to her."
She paused.
"You doing okay?"
"Yeah," I said, thrown once again by her casual demeanor. "I'm fine. You looking forward to trick-or-treating?"
"It'll be fun. I picked up an amazing costume for London. It's Belle from Beauty and the Beast, but extra glittery."
"She'll love that," I agreed. She named one of her fish Belle.
"Make sure you come by in time to see it."
"You want me to come by?" She rolled her eyes, but in them I saw only disbelief, not anger, as though I were merely clueless rather than hateful.
"Of course, Russ. She's your daughter. It's Halloween. And besides, you need to be here to hand out candy for the kids who come by the house. What did you think was going on tomorrow night?"
As usual, Vivian had managed to keep me guessing. I hadn't seen Marge and Liz since London's birthday party, so I swung by my parents the next afternoon before the trick-or-treating got underway. I noticed right off that Marge had slimmed down even more. She looked fantastic, but it was on the tip of my tongue to tell her not to lose much more weight, as it might make her face look too severe. Liz, too, looked like she'd shed some pounds, though not as much. Marge and Liz enveloped me in hugs as soon as I stepped through the door. "So this is what you look like after a vacation, huh?" I said to Marge, giving a low whistle.
"I know, pretty fab, huh? I weigh as much as I did in college now."
"You look great, too, Liz. Are you sure the two of you weren't secretly at Canyon Ranch the whole time?"
"Thank you, but no," she said. "It was all just good old-fashioned hiking and sightseeing, and like Marge, I kept my servings of rice and beans to a minimum."
"I'm jealous. I've stopped losing weight, even though I'm still running."
"How are things?" Marge asked. "When I talked to Mom last night, she said you landed some new clients. Let's go out back and talk for a while."
"All right. Let me say hi to Mom and Dad, and I'll meet you outside in a few." Visiting with my parents took 15 minutes. Mom didn't bring up the cancer, thank goodness, and I found my sister and Liz on the back patio, both of them drinking tall glasses of sweet tea. For the next hour, we talked about their trip, the zip lines, arenal volcanoes, hikes through the cloud forest and near the coast, and I caught them up on all that had been going on in my world. Just as that part of the conversation was coming to a close, my mom popped her head out and asked Liz if she'd mind giving her a hand in the kitchen.
"So, you were told you had to communicate through attorneys, but then she showed up at the house and acted as if everything were normal?"
I nodded. "Don't ask me to explain it. I'm just thanking God for small favors."
"What I still don't understand is why Vivian got London for both her birthday and on Halloween. You should get London for some of the fun things, too."
It's just the way the weekends are falling. Marge didn't seem satisfied with this explanation, but apparently decided to let it drop.
How do you feel about selling the house?
I guess I'm torn. We don't need a place that big. To be honest, we never really did. But at the same time, there are a lot of memories there. Anyway, I don't have much of a choice. Even though my business is finally taking off, it's not like I'll have enough in the bank to pay Vivian off when we sign the papers. I paused. It's hard for me to believe it's been almost 2 months since she walked out the door. In some ways, it seems like yesterday. In other ways, it feels like forever.
I can't imagine, Marge said.
She turned her head and covered her mouth, coughing from somewhere deep in her chest.
You're still sick?
No, she answered. This is just a remnant from the bronchitis. Apparently it can take the lungs months to heal, even when the inflammation is gone. I felt pretty good in Costa Rica, but right now I need a vacation from my vacation. Liz kept us on the go the whole time. I'm still wiped out. And my knees are killing me from all the hiking. Hiking is good exercise, but it's rough on the joints, I conceded.
Speaking of which, let me know if you and Emily ever want to go hiking with Liz and me. It'll be like old times.
I will, I said. At my answer, Marge tilted her head.
Uh-oh, I'm sensing there's trouble in paradise. Is there anything you're not telling me?
Not really, I hedged. I just don't know where the relationship is going. Marge scrutinized me.
Why can't you just be happy with what you have with her right now? Because it seems to me like she's been a rock to you these past couple of months.
She has.
Then just appreciate her for that. And let it be what it's going to be.
I hesitated. Vivian thinks that hanging out with Emily and the kids is confusing to London. And she's right. Marge made a skeptical face. But in the end, she folded her hands on the table and leaned toward me.
So don't bring London and Bodhi, she said pointedly. Why don't you just try going out with her?
Like on a date?
Yes, Marge said. Like a date.
What about London?
Liz and I would be more than happy to babysit. And besides, didn't you just say that London was going to be in Atlanta in a couple of weeks? Seize the day, little brother.
On Halloween night, Vivian was unusually warm, even insisting that she take a photo of me with London on her phone, which she then texted to me right away. I handed out candy to the neighborhood kids. There were so many coming by the house, I sat in the rocking chair on the front porch so I wouldn't have to keep getting up from the couch. The next morning, I woke to a text from Vivian that said she'd be leaving around 6, and could I try to be home by then? On the way out the door that evening, she pulled me into a hug and whispered to me that I was doing a great job with London. The first couple of weeks of November blurred together in a string of 18-hour days, marked by the routines that had become second nature. I exercised, worked, took care of London, who started back with piano lessons. Cooked, cleaned, and made nightly calls to Emily. Thanks to my new clients, I was so busy that I didn't even have time to swing by my parents the following weekend, nor visit with Marge and Liz even once. A few things from that period do stand out in my memory, however. The week after Halloween, I had a realtor come by so I could put the house up for sale. She walked through and asked a lot of questions. Toward the end, she suggested that I rearrange the furniture to show the rooms to better effect. One by one, at her suggestion, the pieces ended up back where Vivian had originally placed them. Before she left, she retrieved a mallet from her car and pounded a bright red realty sign into the yard out front. The sight of the sign made something sink inside me, and out of instinct, I called Emily. As usual, she brought me back onto solid ground, even encouraging me with the prospect of turning to a fresh page in my life, in a new home. Maybe it was the prospect of Vivian taking London to Atlanta for the weekend. But as the conversation was winding down, I found myself thinking about Marge's suggestion that I ask Emily out. Before I could gather my courage, however, Emily spoke up.
Russ, I've been meaning to ask you, would you like to accompany me to the opening of the art show I told you about? The one that's going to include a few of my paintings?
She sounded a bit nervous, and I could almost picture her smoothing her hair behind her ear, the way she always did when she was anxious.
I mean, it's fine if you can't, but since the opening is the weekend when London's going to be in Atlanta, I thought...
I'd love to, I interrupted. I'm so glad you asked. As the weekend of November 13th approached, I helped London prepare for her trip to Atlanta, which took more time than I thought it would. London was excited at the idea of visiting Vivian in her new apartment and packed and repacked her suitcase 4 or 5 times. She fretted for days over what to bring, ultimately packing several different outfits, in addition to Barbies, coloring books, crayons, and the book 2x2. Vivian had texted that she would pick London up at 5, which I interpreted to mean she'd drive both ways. Of course, I'd forgotten about Spannerman's private jet, but I was reminded of that as soon as the limousine pulled to a stop in front of the house. I carried London's bag to the car and handed it to the driver. By then, London had crawled into the limousine and was already exploring the plush interior. It hurt to see her leaving, even if she was with her mom.
"I'll have her back here Sunday about 7, Vivian said. "And of course you can call any time and I'll put her on the phone."
"I'll try not to be a nuisance about it."
"You're her father," Vivian said. "You're not a nuisance."
She looked away before continuing.
"And just so you know, she's not going to meet Walter this weekend. It's too soon for him to meet her. I wouldn't do that to her."
I nodded, surprised. And yes, undeniably grateful. "Do you have any big plans?" I asked, somehow eager to prolong their departure.
"There are a lot of things to do there. I think we'll play it by ear, but I should probably be going. I don't want it to be too late when we get to the apartment."
This time, there was no hug. As she turned away, however, her eyes caught the sight of the realty sign, and she paused. Then, with a resolute flick of her hair over her shoulder, she moved to the open door and the driver closed it behind her. I watched the limo pull away, feeling strangely bereft. Despite everything that had happened at this point, there always seemed to be another way to remind me that I'd lost the future I'd once imagined. I don't know why the thought of attending Emily's gallery opening made me nervous. Emily and I had coffee together practically every weekend. We talked on the phone most nights, and I'd spent an evening drinking wine on our back patio. We'd spent whole days on expeditions with the kids. Moreover, we would be attending an event at which her work, not mine, would be on display. So if anyone should be nervous, it stood to reason it should be her. Even so, my heart was beating faster than usual, and my mouth had gone slightly dry when Emily answered the knock at her front door. One look at her framed in the doorway didn't help. I wasn't sure how artists were supposed to look at their openings, but gone was any trace of the easygoing mom with whom I was so familiar. In her place stood a ravishing woman in a strappy black cocktail dress, her hair tumbling in a glossy waterfall past her shoulders. I noticed she was wearing just enough makeup to make it seem she was wearing none at all.
"You're right on time," she said, leaning in for a quick hug. "And don't you look sharp?"
I'd gone with what Vivian referred to as a Hollywood look. Black blazer, black slacks, and a black V-neck sweater. I wasn't sure what I was supposed to wear, I admitted, still feeling the imprint of her brief hug.
"Let me just make sure the babysitter has everything she needs. Then we can go, okay?"
I watched as she climbed the stairs and heard her speaking to the babysitter. At the top of the stairs, she hugged and kissed Bodie before returning to the foyer.
"Shall we?"
"Absolutely," I said, certain that she was one of the most beautiful women I'd ever seen. But only on one condition.
"What's that?"
"You have to give me some pointers on gallery opening etiquette." She laughed, the carefree sound loosening the knot of tension in my diaphragm.
"We'll talk on the way," she said,
moving toward the foyer closet and grabbing a cashmere wrap.
"But let's scoot out of here before Bodie realizes he forgot something critical, and it takes another 20 minutes before we can escape."
I opened the front door and watched as she led the way, noting how the dress hugged her figure just right. My eyes drifted lower until I flashed on the memory of the night she'd helped me with my bow tie, which made me flush and lift my gaze. I backed the car onto the street and steered it in the direction of downtown, where the gallery was located.
"So is this show a big deal for you?" I asked.
"I know you've been working like crazy to get all the paintings ready."
"It's not a major exhibit at MoMA or anything like that, but the owner of the gallery does a nice job. He's been in business for a long time, so once a year he invites his best customers to a private showing. A few of them are prominent regional collectors. Usually there are 6 or 7 artists, but this year, I think he said he's showcasing the work of 9 artists. 2 sculptors, a glass artist, an artist who works in ceramics, and 5 painters."
"And you're one of them?"
"I'm one of the painters every year."
"How many does he represent?"
30, maybe?"
"See? And you're so humble, I never would have known."
"I'm humble because my paintings don't sell for much money.
It's not like anything I've done will ever see the inside of Sotheby's or Christie's. Of course, most of the artists whose work sells for a gazillion dollars are dead.
That doesn't seem fair. You're preaching to the choir, she teased. And what role do you play at the opening?
Well, it's kind of like a mixer, and I'm one of several hosts. There will be wine and appetizers, and I'll hang around in the general vicinity of my work, in case any of the guests have questions or want to talk to me.
What if they want to buy a piece?
Then the guests will talk to the gallery owner. It's not really my place to discuss what a painting is worth. As much as I was joking about the big bucks, I don't like to think of art in terms of money. People should buy a piece because they love it, because it speaks to them.
Or because it looks good hanging on the wall?
Or that, she said, smiling.
I'm excited to see what you've done. I'm sorry I didn't make it to the gallery before now.
Russ, you're a busy single dad, she said, giving my arm a reassuring squeeze. I'm just glad you agreed to come with me tonight. It'll give me someone to talk to when no one is looking at my work. It's a little dispiriting to stand next to your work and watch people ignore it, or avert their gaze so you won't try to talk to them.
Has that ever happened to you?
Every time, she said. Not everyone who shows up will like my work. Art is subjective.
I like your work. What I've seen on your walls, I mean.
She laughed. That's because you like me.
I looked over at her. True enough.
By the time we reached the gallery, any trace of nervousness had passed. As ever, Emily made being around her easy because she was so clearly comfortable with me. I had forgotten how liberating that feeling of acceptance was, and when we paused at the door, I found myself staring at her and wondering how different my life would have been had I married her rather than Vivian. Emily caught me staring and tilted her head. What are you thinking about?
I hesitated. I was thinking how glad I am that London and Bodhi are friends. She squinted at me, a skeptical gleam in her eye.
I'm not sure you were thinking about the kids just then.
No?
No, she said with a knowing smile. I'm pretty sure you were thinking about me.
It must be a wonderful thing to be able to read minds.
It is, she said. And for my next trick, watch this. I'm going to enter the gallery without even touching the door.
How are you going to do that? She feigned disappointment.
You're not even going to open the door for me? I thought you were a gentleman.
I laughed and pulled open the door for her.
The interior of the building was brightly lit, with the look of an industrial loft. A large, open space with several groups of wall partitions that rose partway to the ceiling. Paintings were mounted on the partitions, and I could see about 20 people clustered among the artwork, most holding glasses of wine or champagne flutes. Waiters and waitresses circulated, bearing silver trays of appetizers.
Lead the way, I said. You're the star tonight.
Emily scanned the room and we started toward a patrician-looking gray-haired gentleman. This turned out to be Claude Barnes, the owner of the gallery. With him were two couples, both of whom had driven in from other cities to attend the show. I snagged a couple of glasses of wine from a passing waiter and handed one to Emily while we engaged in small talk. I saw Emily point toward a set of partitions in the rear of the gallery, and after the conversation came to an end, we ambled over. I took a few minutes to examine her paintings, thinking to myself that they were not only arrestingly beautiful, but mysterious. While the paintings I'd seen in her home had been abstract, in these I saw more realistic elements. The colors practically exploded off the canvas and were coupled with stark brushwork. One painting in particular continued to draw my eye. These are spectacular, I said, meaning it. I can't imagine how much work they required.
Which is the one that was giving you fits?
This one, she said, pointing to the one that had caught my eye. I studied it up close, then took a few steps back, examining it from various angles. It's perfect, I said. I still don't think it's done, she said, shaking her head, but thank you.
I mean it, I said. I want to buy it.
Oh, okay, she said, at once doubtful and flattered. Are you sure? You don't even know how much it costs.
I want to buy it, I repeated. Really? When she saw I was sincere, she actually blushed.
Wow, I'm honored, Russ. I'll see if I can get Claude to give you the friends and family discount.
I took a sip of my wine. Now what?
We wait and see if anyone comes by, she winked. And if they do, let me do the talking, okay?
I don't want to be a modern-day Margaret Keane.
Who? Margaret Keane was an artist whose husband took credit for her work for years, They made her life story into a movie called Big Eyes. You should see it.
Why don't we watch it together one evening?
Deal.
As the gallery continued to fill, I listened to Emily explain her work to interested patrons. My role, if I had one, was to take photographs using people's phones. It seemed like practically everyone who came by wanted a picture with Emily, presumably because she was the artist, but after a while I noticed that none of the other artists seemed nearly as popular. While Emily was chatting with various guests, I wandered among the exhibits of the other artists. A few of the sculptures caught my attention, but they were so large and abstract, I couldn't imagine how they could possibly look good in someone's home. I also liked the work of some of the other painters, though in my opinion Emily's work was better. Emily and I nibbled steadily on appetizers as the crowds ebbed and flowed. The flow of visitors reached its peak around 8 p.m. and then began to dwindle. While the show was supposed to be over at 9 p.m., Claude didn't lock the doors until the last guest left at 9:45 p.m.
"I think that went well," he said as he approached. "A number of the guests expressed interest in your work. It wouldn't surprise me if you sold out in the next few days."
Emily turned to me. "Are you sure you still want to buy that painting?"
"I do," I said, conscious that it was a luxury I could ill afford right now. But somehow I didn't care.
Claude frowned slightly, aware, no doubt, that a steep discount request would be coming. The frown vanished as quickly as it had come.
"Are there any other pieces you're interested in, from the other artists?"
"No," I said, "just the one."
"Can we talk about this tomorrow, Claude?"
Emily asked.
"It's getting a little late, and I'm too tired to talk business."
"Of course," he said. "Thank you for everything you did tonight, Emily," he said. "You're always so good at these things. Your personality endears you to others."
Standing close to Emily, I knew that Claude was right.
"What would you like to do now?" I asked on the way to the car. "If you're tired, I can bring you home."
"Are you kidding?" she asked. "I've got a babysitter, and I said I wouldn't be home until midnight."
I only told Claude that I was tired so we could get out of there. Once Claude starts talking, it's sometimes hard to get him to stop. I love the guy, but I only have a babysitter once in a blue moon, and I'm going to take advantage of it.
"Do you feel like having dinner? We might be able to find something that's still open."
"I'm stuffed," she said. "But how about a cocktail?"
"Do you have a favorite watering hole?"
"Russ, I'm the mother of a 5-year-old. I don't get out much. But I've heard that Fahrenheit has stunning views and fire pits. And since it's chilly tonight, sitting by a fire sounds perfect."
"I just took London there for a date night."
"Great minds think alike."
Soon thereafter, we found ourselves at Fahrenheit's rooftop bar, warming ourselves before a glowing fire pit and taking in the carpet of city lights below. I ordered 2 glasses of wine from a passing cocktail waitress. Emily sat swaddled in her cashmere wrap, eyes half closed, her expression serene. She looked extraordinarily beautiful in the rosy glow of the firelight, and when she noticed me staring, she gave me a lazy smile.
"I remember that look," she said. "You used to stare at me like that way back when, 1 million years ago.
"Yeah?"
"Sometimes it gave me goosebumps."
"But not anymore, right?"
Her coy shrug told me otherwise. "I know I've said that I'm glad you've come into my life." When I stopped, she raised her eyes to look at me.
"But?"
I decided to tell the truth. "I'm not sure I'm ready for a relationship." For a moment, she said nothing.
"All right,"
she murmured finally, with the faintest echo of regret. "I'm sorry."
"Why are you sorry?"
"Because I've been calling too much. Maybe leading you to think that I was ready when I know I'm not. I'm still an emotional wreck at times. I still think about Vivian way too much. Not that I want her back, because I've realized that I don't. But she's still front and center in a way that's not healthy. And you've been so generous, listening to me when I'm down, offering endless emotional support, and best of all, making me laugh." When I trailed off, I could feel her eyes inspecting me.
"Have I ever complained that you call too much? Or that your confidences are a burden?"
I shook my head, feeling as if some epiphany were trying to surface in my chaotic brain, like an air bubble rising through water. "No," I said, "you haven't."
"You're describing a scenario in which you haven't offered me anything in return, but you have."
The reddish tints in her dark hair glinted in the firelight as she pushed it away from her face. Leaning toward me, she said,
"I like hearing from you, whether you're in a good mood or not. I like knowing that I can talk to you about anything, that you'll understand because we once shared a history. I like feeling that you know the real me, faults and all.
You don't have any faults, I said. Not that I can see anyway. She gave a snort of disbelief.
Are you kidding? No one's perfect, Russ. I like to think I've learned some lessons over the past decade, and maybe I'm more patient than I used to be. But I'm far from perfect.
The waitress delivered our wine, and in the silence that followed, our thoughts seemed to take a more serious turn. Emily took a sip of wine, and when she turned toward me again, I thought I saw a flash of vulnerability cross her face. I'm sorry, I said. I know I'm probably putting a damper on the evening.
Not at all, she said. It means so much that you're honest with me, Russ. I think that's what I like most about you. You're not afraid to tell me things. That you're hurting, that you're afraid of failure, that you're not ready for a relationship. You don't realize how hard it is for some people to say such things. David never could. I never knew what he was really feeling. Half the time, I don't think he even did. But with you, it's different. You're so open. I always admired that about you, and it hasn't changed.
She paused as if uncertain whether to go on.
I really like you, Russ. You're good for me.
That's the thing, Emily. I don't just like you. I think I'm in love with you. My words seemed to electrify her.
You think?
No, I said with growing certainty. I am in love with you. It feels strange to say that when I know I'm not really ready to take further steps, but that's how I feel. For a moment, I stared into the fire, trying to summon my courage. I'm not the kind of guy you should love. You can do a lot better than me. Maybe in time... Saying the words hurt more than I anticipated, and I broke off, feeling a knot forming in my throat. In the silence, Emily stared at me. Then she reached over and laid her open hand on my leg, beckoning for me to take it. I did, feeling a flood of warmth and encouragement as her fingers intertwined with my own.
Did you think that I might be in love with you too?
You don't have to say that.
I'm not just saying it, Russ. I know what love feels like. Maybe I've always loved you. God knows I loved you once with every fiber of my being. I don't think that kind of feeling just goes away. It leaves its mark on you.
She held my gaze, her voice gentle.
I'm okay with waiting until you're ready, because I like what we have now. I like that you've become one of my closest friends, and I know how much you care for me. Do you remember what I said about friendship? It's about someone who walks into your life, says, I'm here for you, and then proves it.
I nodded.
You might not believe it, but you've been doing that for me. I don't know if I'm ready for a relationship either. What I do know is that I want you in my life, and that the thought of losing you again would break my heart.
Where does that leave us then?
How about we just sit by the fire, you and me, and enjoy tonight? We can be friends tonight and tomorrow and for as long as you'd like. And you keep calling, and we keep talking and having coffee when the kids are at art. And like everybody in the world, we'll just take things one day at a time.
I stared at her, marveling at her wisdom and how simple she made it all seem. I love you, Emily.
I love you too, Russ. She gave my hand a squeeze. It's going to be fine. Trust me.
Later that night, I lay awake in bed. Emily and I had lingered for another hour by the fire, letting the meaning of everything that had been said sink in. When I dropped her off at home, I felt the urge to kiss her, but was afraid of upsetting our newfound balance. Emily sensed my hesitation and simply leaned in for a hug. We held each other for a long time beneath her porch light, and the intimacy of that moment struck me as more real and more meaningful than anything else she could have done.
"Call me tomorrow, okay?"
she whispered, releasing me, but not before raising a tender hand to my face. I will. And with that, she turned and went inside. The last 2 weeks of November were some of the happiest in my recent memory. My anniversary passed without incident. Neither Vivian nor I mentioned it when she FaceTimed with London, and it wasn't until after the call had ended that I even remembered it at all. At work, I was proving to be hugely productive on behalf of my new clients. London returned from Atlanta on Sunday night. And though she'd had a good time, she slipped back into her routine without a fuss. I spoke to Emily every day and worked out a deal with Claude to buy her painting, which I then mounted in the family room. I saw Marge, Liz, and my parents the following weekend, the day after Marge and Liz had met with the fertility specialist. While we were all seated in the family room together, they told my parents about their plans.
It's about time, my mom cried, jumping up to hug them both.
You'll be good parents, my dad added. He sounded as gruff as always before he embraced Marge and Liz in return. With hugs from my dad as rare as solar eclipses, I knew they were touched.
Through Taglieri, I learned that Vivian wanted London in Atlanta for the Thanksgiving weekend. Actually, she wanted London beginning on Wednesday evening through Sunday. I wasn't happy about that. But again, the every other weekend pattern just happened to nail every holiday. Vivian arrived on Wednesday to pick up London in the limo and whisk her off to the jet again. As I watched them pull away, I thought about how quiet the house would be without my daughter for the next 4 days. The house was quiet that weekend, because no one, not even me, was there at all. Instead, that was the weekend when once more, my world began to collapse around me. But this time, it was even worse. How did it happen? Like it always seems to happen, seemingly without warning. But of course, in retrospect, there had been warnings all along. It was Saturday morning, November 28th, 2 days after Thanksgiving. I'd spent the previous evening with Emily, dining out and visiting the Charlotte Comedy Zone. Once again, I was tempted to kiss her at the end of the evening, but settled instead for another long and glorious hug, one that confirmed my desire to keep her in my life for a long, long time. My feelings for her were already displacing thoughts of Vivian in a way that I hadn't anticipated, and that I hoped would continue. I felt undeniably lighter and more positive about the future than I had in months, if not years. The call came in on early Saturday morning. It wasn't yet 6 a.m. when the house phone began to ring, and the sound itself was ominous. My cell phone was on airplane mode, and no one would call the house at that hour unless something terrible had happened. I knew even before I picked up the phone that it was my mother on the other end, and I knew that she was calling to tell me that my father was in the hospital. He'd had a heart attack, or something worse. I knew she would be frantic, probably in tears. But it wasn't my mom on the other end of the line. It was Liz, calling about my sister. Marge, she told me, had been admitted to the hospital. She'd been coughing up blood for an hour.
Chapter 23. No.
When Marge was 11, she and my mom were involved in a car accident. Back then, my mom was still driving one of those huge wood-paneled station wagons. Because they were from a different generation, my parents weren't accustomed to wearing seatbelts, and as a family, we rarely did. Marge liked seatbelts even less than I did. Whereas I simply forgot to put mine on when I hopped in the car, I was still young, remember? Marge deliberately chose not to wear them, because it allowed her more freedom to punch or pinch me whenever the mood struck. Which, I might add, was way too often. I wasn't in the car that day, and though I'm not sure how accurate my recollections are, it seems the accident was no fault of my mom's. She wasn't speeding, the road wasn't busy, and she was passing through an intersection while the light was green. Meanwhile, a teenager, probably fiddling with the radio or scarfing down McDonald's French fries, blew through the red light and broadsided the rear of the station wagon. While my mom was a little banged up, it was Marge whom everyone was most worried about. The momentum from the crash had thrown her into the side windows, shattering the glass. While she wasn't unconscious when she arrived at the hospital, she was bleeding and bruised, and had sustained a broken collarbone. When I entered Marge's hospital room with my dad, the sight of my sister scared me. At 6 years old, I didn't know much about death or even hospitals. My dad stood over her bed, his expression flat, but I could tell by his posture that he was frightened, which scared me even more. Looking down at my stricken face, he frowned. "Come see your sister, Russ."
"I don't want to," I can remember saying.
"I don't care what you want," he said. "I told you to come here, and you're going to do what I tell you." His tone brooked no argument, and I inched toward the bed. Marge's face was grossly swollen, with deep bruises and multiple stitches, like she'd been sewn back together. She didn't look like my sister. She didn't look like anyone. She looked like a monster in a scary movie, and the sight of her caused me to burst into tears. To this day, I wish I hadn't cried. My dad thought I was crying for Marge, and I felt him lay a comforting hand on my shoulder, which made me cry even harder. But I wasn't crying for Marge. I was crying for myself, because I was afraid. And over time, I came to despise myself for my reaction. Some people have courage.
On that day, I learned that I wasn't one of them. The doctors didn't know what was wrong with Marge. Nurses took samples of blood and x-rayed her chest. That was followed by a CAT scan. Three different doctors came to examine her. I watched as a needle was inserted into Marge's lungs to remove tissue for further examination. Throughout it all, Marge was the only one who didn't seem worried. Part of that had to do with the fact that since she'd arrived at the hospital, her coughing had abated. She joked with the doctors and nurses while Liz and my parents looked on with grim concern, and I thought again about how effective my sister was at hiding her fears, even from those who loved her. Meanwhile, in another part of the hospital, tests were being run. I heard the doctor whispering words like pathology and radiology, biopsy, oncology. Liz was clearly worried, but not yet panicked. My parents sat like stones, barely holding it together. And I was upset because Marge didn't look good. Her skin had a grayish pallor, which accentuated her weight loss. And I found myself replaying all that I'd seen and the things she'd said over the last few months. The racking cough that never seemed to go away. The soreness in her legs. How exhausted she'd been after her vacation. My parents and I, Liz and the doctors, were all thinking about the same thing. The cancer. But it couldn't be cancer. Marge couldn't be that sick. She was my sister and she was only 40 years old. A little more than a week ago, she'd gone to a specialist because she wanted to have a baby. She was looking forward to being pregnant. She had her entire life ahead of her. Marge couldn't be sick. She didn't have the cancer. No. 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 I was thankful that Vivian had taken London to Atlanta, because I don't know what I would have done with her all day. I spent hours drifting in and out of Marge's hospital room. When I couldn't take it anymore, I would pace the parking lot or have coffee in the cafeteria. I called Emily and shared what was going on. I asked her not to come by, but she came anyway. Marge and Emily had a short but sweet reunion a little before noon, and in the hallway afterward, Emily held me as I shook with fear. She told me that she wanted to see me later, if I was up to it, and I promised that I'd call. Finally, I called Vivian. When I told her what was going on, she gave a strangled gasp and immediately offered to fly back with London right away. I explained that London was probably better off with her, at least through the weekend. Vivian understood. "Oh, Russ," she said quietly, sounding nothing like her usual brisk self. "I'm so sorry." "Don't be sorry yet," I said. "We don't know anything for sure." I was lying to myself, and both Vivian and I knew it. She was well aware of the history on my mother's side of the family. As I spoke again, I could hear my voice cracking. "Do me a favor and don't say anything to London yet, okay?"
"Of course not. Is there anything I can do? What do you need?"
"Nothing for now," I said.
"Thanks."
Words were becoming hard to form, my thoughts beginning to scatter.
"I'll let you know." "Keep me informed, okay?"
"I will," I promised, and I knew that I would. After all, we were still married. In the afternoon, while my parents and Liz were visiting the cafeteria, I stayed with Marge. She asked about my work, and at her insistence, I described the ad campaigns I was crafting for my clients. I think she remembered that day in the hospital so long ago, after the auto accident, and could tell how frightened I was. She knew I could speak about work on autopilot, so she kept asking questions to distract me. As had become her habit, she asked about Emily, and I finally admitted that I'd fallen in love, but wasn't ready to tell our parents yet. At that, she cracked a grin.
"Too late. Mom and Dad already know."
"How? I haven't said anything to them."
"You didn't have to," she said. "When you called Emily on Thanksgiving, the way you felt about her was plain as day." Mom raised her eyebrows while Dad turned to me and said, "Already? He's not even divorced yet."
Despite everything, I laughed. That was my dad, all right. I didn't realize it was so obvious.
"Uh-huh,"
she said, nodding.
"I just wish you hadn't waited until today to bring her by. I look like hell. You should have had us meet right after Costa Rica when I was still tan."
I nodded, struck by how normal Marge sounded. "My bad."
"I'd like to meet Bodhi, too, since I've heard so much about him."
"I'm sure you'll have a chance." She twisted the hospital sheet, winding it tight and letting it unfurl.
"I've been thinking about baby names," she said.
I bought one of those books, you know. At work, whenever I'm bored, I look through it. I even started highlighting some of them.
Baby names?
Was she really talking about baby names?
I could feel pressure behind my eyes, and I struggled to get the words out without my voice cracking. Any favorites?
If it's a boy, I like Josiah, Elliot, Carter. If it's a girl, I like Meredith and Alexis. Of course, Liz is going to have her own ideas, but I haven't spoken to her about it yet. It's still pretty early in the process, so we have plenty of time to make a decision.
Plenty of time. Marge must have heard herself because she looked first toward the clock, then the door of the room, which was propped open. Nurses hurried past, going about their duties as if today were no different than any other day.
I wonder when they're going to finally let me out of here, she said. What's taking them so long? I've been here for hours already. Don't they know I have things to do?
When I had no answer to that, Marge sighed.
You know I'm going to be okay, right?
I mean, I'm not ignoring what happened this morning, but I don't feel all that bad. I feel a lot better than I did before I left for Costa Rica, in fact. I probably just picked up some parasite while I was down there. Lord only knows what the sanitary standards are like in those kitchens.
We'll see what the doctors say, I murmured. If you see them, tell them to hurry up. I'd rather not waste my whole weekend here.
I will. Marge continued to wind and unwind the sheet.
London comes back tomorrow, right?
She does. I don't know what time exactly. Early evening, I'd guess.
Why don't you bring London over for dinner with Liz and me this week? You've been so busy lately, we haven't had time for our normal sit-downs.
Watching her work the sheet, I could feel my throat tightening again. Dinner sounds great, but none of that Costa Rican food. What with all the parasites, right?
Yeah, she said, looking right at me. Trust me when I tell you that you don't want what I have.
The day crawled by. Mid-afternoon. Late afternoon. Vivian texted, asking if there was any news. I replied that we were still waiting. Emily texted, asking how I was doing. Scared to death, I replied. As dusk approached, the sky began to cloud over. Marge's hospital room was bathed in flat gray light, and the TV was turned to Judge Judy, though on mute. The machine monitoring her vitals beeped steadily. A doctor that we hadn't met came into the room. Though his demeanor was steady, his expression was grim, and I already knew what he was going to tell us. He introduced himself as Dr. Kadam Patel, and he was an oncologist. Over his shoulder in the hallway, I watched as a young girl in a wheelchair was rolled past the room. In her arms was a stuffed animal, a purple pig. Just as my mother had dreamed. I went blank, my mind tuning out almost as soon as he began to speak. I caught various bits and pieces. Adenocarcinoma. More common in women than men. More likely to occur in younger people. Non-small cell. Slower growing than other types of lung cancer, but unfortunately it's advanced, and the CT scan shows that it has metastasized to other parts of the body. Both lungs, lymph nodes, bones, and her brain. Malignant, pericardial effusion, stage 4, incurable. Incurable. My mom was the first to let out a cry, the plaintive wail of a mother who knows that her child is dying. Liz followed a moment later, and my dad took her in his arms. He said nothing, but his lower lip trembled while he squeezed his eyes shut, as if trying to block out reality. Marge sat unmoving on the bed. Watching her, I felt as though I would topple over, but somehow I remained upright. Marge kept her gaze fixed on the doctor.
How long do I have?
She asked, and for the first time that day, I heard fear in her voice. It's impossible to say, Dr. Patel answered. Though it's incurable, it's treatable. Treatment has improved exponentially in the last 10 years. It can not only prolong life, it can alleviate some of the symptoms.
How long? Marge demanded. With treatment.
If we had caught it earlier, Dr. Patel hedged, before it had metastasized.
But we didn't, Marge said, cutting him off.
Dr. Patel stood a bit straighter.
Again, there's no way to know exactly. You're young and in good condition, both of which increase life expectancy.
I understand that it's not a question that you want to answer. I also understand that every patient is different, which means you can't really know for sure. What I want, though, is your best guess.
Marge's voice made it clear she would not be deterred.
Do you think I have a year?
The doctor didn't answer, but his expression was pained.
6 months?
Marge pressed, and again, the doctor didn't answer.
3?
Right now, Dr. Patel said, I think it would be best if we start discussing treatment options. It's critical that we get started right away.
I don't want to discuss treatment,
Marge said. I could hear anger in her voice.
If you think I only have a few months, if you're telling me it's incurable, then what's the point?
Liz had collected herself enough to wipe her eyes. She moved toward the bed and took Marge's hand. Lifting it to her mouth, she kissed it.
Baby,
she whispered.
I want to hear what the doctor says about treatment options, okay? I know you're afraid, but I need to know. Can you listen? For me?
For the first time, Marge turned from the doctor. The trail of her tear had left a streak on her cheek that the light caught, making it shine.
Okay,
Marge whispered, and only then did Marge begin to cry. Systemic chemotherapy. Over the next 40 minutes, the doctor patiently explained to us his reasoning for the course of treatment he was recommending. Because the cancer was so advanced, because it had spread throughout Marge's body and reached her brain, there were no real surgical options. Radiation was a possibility, but again, because of the spread, the benefits weren't worth the costs. Usually, patients were given more time to consider all the pros and cons of chemotherapy, including side effects, and he went over those in detail. But again, because the cancer was so advanced, the doctor strongly recommended that Marge start immediately. To do that, Marge would need a catheter. When that part was underway, my parents and I left the room to go to the cafeteria. We didn't speak. Instead, we sat in silence, each of us simply trying to process what was happening. I ordered coffee that I didn't drink, thinking that chemotherapy is essentially poison, and the hope is that the cancer cells are killed before normal cells. Too much poison and the patient dies. Too little poison, and the medicine does no good at all. My sister had already known all this. My parents and I had known all this as well. We had grown up knowing about the cancer. All of us knew about stages and survival rates, and possible remission and catheters and side effects. The cancer, after all, spread not only through human bodies. Sometimes it spread through families, like mine. Later, I returned to the room, and I took a seat in the chair, watching as the poison was administered, killing as it flowed through her system. I left the hospital when the sky had turned black, and I walked my parents to their car. To me, it seemed like they were shuffling rather than walking, and for the first time, they seemed old. Beaten down and utterly wrung out. I knew, because I was feeling the same way. Liz had asked us if she could be alone with Marge. As soon as she asked, I felt guilty. Lost in my own feelings about Marge, it didn't occur to me that the two of them needed time together, without an audience. After watching my parents pull out of the parking lot, I walked slowly to my car. I knew I couldn't stay at the hospital, but I didn't want to go home. I didn't want to go anywhere. What I wanted was to be able to rewind, to return to yesterday. 24 hours earlier, I had been having dinner with Emily and looking forward to an evening of laughter. The stand-ups at the Comedy Zone were good, and although one of the routines had been a bit too profane for my taste, the second comedian was both married and a father, and the humorous stories he related had the sweet ring of familiarity. At one point, I reached for Emily's hand, and when I felt her fingers intertwine with my own, I felt as though I'd come home. This, I remember thinking, is what life is really about. Love and laughter and friendship. Happy times spent with those you care about. As I drove home, yesterday seemed impossibly distant, a different lifetime altogether. The axis of my world had shifted, and like my parents, I'd aged in the last few hours. I'd been hollowed out. And as I squinted through eyes that had gone blurry with tears, I wondered if I would ever feel whole again. Emily texted to ask if I was still at the hospital, and when I replied that I'd gone home, she said that she was coming over. She found me on the couch in a house illuminated by a single lamp in the family room. I hadn't risen when she'd knocked at the door, and she'd let herself in. "Hey there," she said, her voice soft. She crossed the room and sat beside me. "Hi," I said. "Sorry I didn't get the door."
"It's fine," she said. "How's Marge? How are you?"
I didn't know how to answer, and I pinched the bridge of my nose. I didn't want to cry anymore. She slipped her arm around me, and I leaned into her. Just like earlier that day, she held me close, and we didn't have to talk at all. Marge was released from the hospital on Sunday. Though she was weak and nauseated, she wanted to go home, and there was no reason to stay at the hospital. The first dose of poison, after all, had already been administered. I pushed the wheelchair, my parents trailing behind me. Liz walked beside the wheelchair, clearing a path in the busy hallways. No one we passed cast a second glance in our direction. It was cold outside. On the way to the hospital, Liz had asked me to swing by their house to get Marge a jacket. She directed me to a key hidden under a rock to the right of the front door. I had let myself in and rummaged through the foyer closet, trying to find something soft and warm. I finally settled on a long down jacket. Before going outside, Liz helped Marge stand so she could slip on the jacket. She winced and wobbled, but kept her balance. Liz and my parents set out for the parking lot together, then veered in opposite directions to find their cars.
"I hate hospitals," Marge said to me. "The only time I've ever been in a good mood in a hospital was when London was born."
"I'm with you," I said. "That's it in my book as well." She pulled at her jacket, pinching it closed around her neck.
"So roll me outside, would you? Let's get out of here."
I did as she asked, feeling a brisk wind nip at my cheeks as soon as we exited the building. The few trees in the parking lot were barren of leaves and the sky was an iron gray. When Marge spoke again, her voice was so soft I almost missed it.
"I'm afraid, Russ," she whispered.
"I know," I said. "I am too."
"It's not fair. I never smoked, I hardly ever drank, I ate right, I exercised."
For a moment, she looked like a child again. I squatted down so I could be at eye level. "You're right, it's not fair." She met my gaze then and barked out a resigned laugh.
"This is all Mom's fault, you know," she said. "Her and the family genes, not that I'd ever say that to her, and not that really I blame her, because I don't."
I'd had the identical thought, but hadn't spoken the words aloud. I knew that my mom was tormented by the same idea, and it was one of the reasons she'd barely spoken while at the hospital. I reached over and took Marge's hand.
"I feel like crap," Marge said. "I've already decided that I hate chemotherapy. I've thrown up 4 times this morning, and now I don't feel like I have enough strength to get to the bathroom on my own."
"I'll help you," I said. "I promise."
"No," she said. "You won't."
"What are you talking about? Of course I will." I'd never seen Marge look so sad. Marge, who shrugged off even the biggest losses with pragmatic insouciance.
"I know that's what you think you should do, and I know that you'll want to."
She gripped my hand.
"But I have Liz, and you have London and your business and Emily."
"I could care less about work right now. Emily will understand, and London is in school most of the time." Marge didn't answer right away. When she spoke, it was as if she were returning to a conversation I didn't know we were having.
"Do you know what I admire about you, among other things?" she said.
"I have no idea."
"I admire your strength and your courage."
"I'm not strong," I protested.
"And I'm not brave." "But you are," she said. "When I look back at the past year and all you've gone through, I'm not sure how you made it. I watched you become the father I always knew you could be. I saw you at your very lowest after Vivian left, and I watched you pull yourself back up. All while launching a business and the struggles that entailed. Not many people could have handled the past 6 months the way you did. I know for a fact that I couldn't have."
"Why are you telling me this?" I asked, uncomprehending.
"Because I'm not going to let you stop doing what you need to do just because of me. That would break my heart."
"I'm going to be here for you," I said. "You can't talk me out of it."
"I'm not asking you to abandon me. I'm asking that you continue to live your life. I'm asking you to be strong and brave again. Because London's not the only one who's going to need you. Liz is going to need you. Mom and Dad, too. One of you has to be the rock, and while you might not believe it, I know in my heart that you've always been the strongest of us all."
Chapter 24, December,
When I think back on Marge as a teenager, two things come to mind. Roller skating and horror films. In the late 80s and early 90s, roller skating was giving way to roller blading. But Marge stayed true to the old-fashioned skates that she had owned as a child. I think she had a soft spot for the disco roller rinks of her early childhood. Weekends during her teenage years were spent almost entirely on skates, usually with her Walkman and headphones on, even, remarkably, after she got her driver's license. There were few things she loved more than roller skating, unless it was a good horror film. Although Marge loved romantic comedies like I did, her favorite genre was horror, and she never missed seeing the latest horror movie in its first week of release. It didn't matter to her if the film had been panned by critics and the public alike. She would happily watch it alone if she couldn't find a fellow enthusiast, as devoted to the genre as a groupie to her favorite band. From Nightmare on Elm Street to Candyman to Amityville 4, The Evil Escapes, Marge was a true aficionado of horror, highbrow and low. When I asked her why she loved horror movies so much, she merely shrugged and said that sometimes she liked to be scared. I didn't get it, any more than I did the allure of rolling around with wheels on your feet. Why would someone want to be scared? Weren't there more than enough scary things in real life to keep us awake at night? Now, though, I think I understand. Marge liked those films precisely because they weren't real. Any fright she felt in the course of the film was quantifiable. It would begin, and then it would end, and she would leave the theater emotionally spent yet relieved that all was well in the world. At the same time, she'd been able to confront, albeit temporarily, one of the hardwired emotions of life, the root of our universal instinct toward fight or flight. By willing herself to stay put despite her fear, I think Marge felt that she would emerge stronger and better equipped to face down whatever actual terrors life had in store for her. In retrospect, I think that Marge might have been onto something. Vivian had returned with London on Sunday evening. Before she left, she hugged me, a longer hug than I'd expected. In it, I could sense her concern, but strangely, her body no longer felt familiar to me. London had enjoyed her visit, but this time she mentioned that she had missed both her fish and Mr. and Mrs. Sprinkles. As soon as she got home, we went up to her room, where she told me that she'd had Thanksgiving dinner in a mansion. I guess that Vivian had introduced our daughter to Spannerman in reaction to seeing London hug Emily at the art studio. To Vivian's mind, no doubt, I'd violated the taboo first, which gave her the right to do so as well. I suppose I should have cared more, but in that moment I didn't. I was worn out, and I'd known that London would meet Spannerman sooner or later anyway. What did it matter if it was this weekend or the next time she was in Atlanta? What did anything matter anymore? While London was occupied with the fish, I decided to clean the hamster cage, since I'd let it slide while London was gone. By then I was accustomed to it, and it took no time at all. I ran the mess to the outdoor garbage can, washed up, then went back upstairs where London was holding Mr. Sprinkles. "Are you hungry, sweetie?" I asked.
"No," she said. "Mommy and me ate on the plane."
"Just making sure," I said. I took a seat on the bed, watching her, but mainly thinking about Marge. My sister wanted me to keep living my life, to act as though nothing had changed. But everything had changed, and I felt hollowed out, as empty as a junked oil drum. I wasn't sure I was capable of doing as Marge asked, and wasn't sure I even wanted to.
"Guess what?"
London said, looking up. "What, sweetheart?"
"For Christmas, I'm going to make Auntie Marge and Auntie Liz a vase, like I did for Mommy, but this time I want to paint fishes on it."
"I'm sure they'll love that." For a moment, London seemed to study me, her gaze unaccountably serious.
"Are you okay, Daddy?"
"Yeah," I answered. "I'm okay."
"You seem sad."
"I am," I thought. "It's all I can do to not fall to pieces." "I just missed you," I said. She smiled and came toward me, still holding the hamster. "Would you like to hold Mr. Sprinkles?" "Sure," I said, as she gently placed him in my hand. The hamster was soft and light, but I could feel his tiny claws scramble for purchase as he shifted into place. His whiskers twitched and he began to sniff my hand.
"Guess what?"
London asked again. I summoned an inquisitive look.
"I can read now."
"Yeah?"
"I read 2x2 all by myself. I read it to Mommy."
I wondered if it wasn't so much reading as reciting from memory. After all, we had read it 100 times together. But again, what did it matter? "Maybe you could show me later?"
"Okay,"
she agreed. She put her arms around me and squeezed.
I love you, Daddy.
I caught the scent of the baby shampoo she still used and felt another ache.